Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac-Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. The hot stove keeps hot stoving along. Jose Altuve signed a five-year, $151 million extension with the Astros. And mere hours after we wrapped up recording last Sunday, Jake Arrieta signed a three-year, $75 million contract with the Phillies. We'd really appreciate if news could not break on Sunday afternoons. Of course, this week we're recording on a Saturday, so something will surely happen once we wrap up here. The Rays number three starter to open the season, bullpen day. We just want to acknowledge that this is a thing that's happening. We're so tired of talking about the Rays, and unlike last week when we said there's nothing left to talk about in relation to free agency and then rambled for a while, there really is nothing left for us to say about the Rays. Undoubtedly, the most disturbing baseball-related news of the week was that of former Astros prospect Danry Vasquez committing an act of domestic violence on camera. The video was released showing the former Corpus Christi Hooks pitcher physically assaulting his fiancée at the team's stadium 2 years ago. When asked of the incident, Vasquez said, "This incident happened almost 2 years ago. I've truly changed. I'm engaging in activities that have helped me change. I've matured as a person, and I know what I did, or at least what was seen, which shouldn't be seen as an example or anything that can be amended." Lance McCullers tweeted, "The issue here is no one cared as much until a video was leaked, and now everyone is outraged. This is the reality of domestic violence. It's always brutal, always sickening. We must fight for victims, video or not. He should be in jail. If you need help, find it. People care." Will news like this ever stop being both devastating and enraging?
I should hope news like this doesn't ever stop being devastating and enraging. If it does, then we have a serious problem as a society. And I think the problem is for a lot of people, it maybe isn't enraging enough. You know, they're willing to look at a quote-unquote apology like Vasquez's and be like, oh, that's sufficient. He's changed. And, like, be content with that. And the fact of the matter is that's not sufficient. He did serious harm to that young woman. They were engaged at the time. They're no longer engaged. He's now either engaged or married to another woman. I don't remember. But it's, you know, obviously the damage was more than done in that, the victim's case. And no amount of apologizing is going to make up for what she endured.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like that Lance McCullers in his tweet highlighted that we should be putting more emphasis on protecting the victims. And I think that it's something that people often don't think enough about, even in just sharing the video that is obviously, you know, very disturbing and can have a very negative triggering impact on a lot of people. And even in when she was asked about this, the video surfacing, his former fiance said that she keeps replaying it in her mind, wondering what she could have done differently. And I think that that's something that needs to be seriously addressed and needs to be brought into the discussion of domestic violence. And it's something that people need to try and confront and try and make it so that victims not only receive the protection once these things come to light, but also understand that what happened to them is in no way their fault.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's been instilled in this culture that, you know, if, you know, they're a victim of domestic violence, it's something that they did, that it's something that they deserve. And in this instance specifically, it's just very hard to stomach especially since there's screenshots of the video and that's been used in the articles, and you don't know who's out there seeing these screenshots who also might be triggered. And, you know, I know in society a lot of people use triggered as a joke, but it's actually, you know, an actual psychological thing. And that for people with PTSD, you know, that's extremely, extremely difficult to live with on a daily basis. And I think that, you know, so often we don't remember that those who survive domestic violence or any type of violent act towards them often have a form of PTSD. And, you know, the, you know, Vasquez's ex-fiance, I suppose, you know, the fact that she's thinking about, you know, what she did wrong, what she could have done to change that incident, it's still something that's embedded not only in, you know, baseball, but, you know, the whole of society, that it's somehow, you know, the victim's fault. It's just straight up victim blaming. And we usually try to say, like, oh, prevent your partner from hitting you. But it's also like, well, how do they stop themselves from hitting you? So I think that's just something that's always going to be enraging. And I think that if that's not enraging to someone, then, you know, their priorities need to be looked at. I am wondering a little bit about McCullough's tweet in the case of, was this publicly available before? I don't know if it was something that, you know, there were rumors spreading around, or if there was actually any chatter of the reason why he was released by the Astros. But,
well, Sports Illustrated, at least, and probably more publications, had an article in August after the incident discussing it and discussing his release from the Astros organization.
Somehow I missed that.
Yeah, well, according to just the Wikipedia page for Vasquez, it says that he was arrested on suspicion of assault family violence after the video cameras captured this incident. And that's when the Astros released him. They, you know, took that action pretty immediately. And, you know, what happened after that was the then fiance did not press charges, and Vasquez just had to pay a fine and take some classes. Then what kind of, I think, brought things back up is that Vasquez signed with an independent league team.
Yeah.
To play for this season. And it was something they chose to do in spite of knowing about his past. And then the footage of the incident was made public. And so that's why, you know, they couldn't hide from it anymore. You know, I think while a lot of our rage is very fairly directed at Vasquez, I do think we kind of need to talk a little bit about how sometimes these leagues can be a safe haven for players like this who, you know, can't get work in MLB anymore necessarily and will go where they are, you know, obviously being paid a much, much lower wage, but nonetheless are given a place where they can still play because, you know, they'll kind of take who they can get more or less.
Yeah, and that's a sad thing about everything, I suppose. I kind of call this the Josh Lukey example, which, you know, a lot of teams saw him as this player who was flawed, and because of those rape charges, they saw Lukey as, oh, he's damaged goods, but he'll come at a cheaper price. And they're willing to sign any good player at a very low premium because they think, oh, he'll help the team, but we're not going to think about, you know, the consequences of signing this player you know, on our fans. You know, and then you're once again reminded baseball is a business, a business that, you know, might not often care about people. And I just kind of sit back and think, like, in instances like this, you wonder how a conversation about how pornography links to domestic violence is a solution when things like this happen. And yeah, it's just,
yeah, something tells me that, you know, I don't know anything about Vasquez's personal life, but I don't think, you know, this was something that probably would not have been prevented by an anti-porn seminar. So yeah, I just hope everybody is taking notes and thinking of better preventative measures, because yeah, we don't want to see anything like this happen again.
Yeah, yeah. I'd really just love for not just baseball, but society as a whole, obviously, but we are a baseball podcast. I just really love to see if baseball would actually do something to not only prevent domestic violence or gendered violence from happening, but also something that would help protect the victims. Because one thing that I wrote about, again, as I mentioned last week in my piece about how baseball needs to do better about sexual violence, is that while, yes, it is one of the correct things to release a player who does something like this, but at the same time, you have to think about the consequences of, will this just put the victim more in harm? Because if they're living together, that just means that the abuser has nowhere left to go, and you don't know if they're going to take out anger on the victim once again. Mm-hmm. So I think better protections for victims would be great.
Yeah, I think teams just need to understand that their responsibility goes beyond just releasing the player, and they have more influence on both protecting victims and helping ensure that these incidents don't occur in the first place than they, you know, might think that they have, or might, you know, at least kind of pretend that they have.
Yeah. In any instance, you know, baseball just needs to do better. Now, after we begged for baseball not to break news over the weekend, at least we were in the middle of recording while this one happened. Jarrell Cotton of the Oakland A's needs Tommy John surgery.
Yeah, I don't think that's much of a surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like this is the way things were heading, but it's always sad when it becomes official.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Oakland A's. They're just, oh, the A's.
Yeah, he was a big part of their plans going forward, and, you know, that's obviously a substantial loss for them. You know, he'll miss like a season and a half, or, you know, whatever it usually, or that's, you know, around what it usually ends up being if you're, you know, performing the surgery, you know, right before the season begins. He'll come back, hopefully, you know, for many players, they manage to come back and be very successful, and hopefully that's what happens in Cotton's case. But it's just really disappointing, because this is a guy who people really saw something in, you know, Pedro Martinez, like, compared him to himself. And I mean, I think that's kind of thing Pedro likes to do, but I don't think it was also, like, there was a pretty decent, like, basis for that in this case. And it's just, you know, you never want to see it happen to anyone, but it's especially disappointing when it's one of the brighter potential future stars of the game.
Indeed. We are joined this week by Editor-in-Chief of BP Mets, Kate Feldman. How are you doing today, Kate?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Good. Thank you.
All right, so BP Mets is looking for new contributors, and he tweeted some frustration with the process, noting that all the applicants thus far happen to be men. Just how disappointing is it to receive no applications from non-men?
I mean, it's incredibly so, and I know it's an unpaid position, so I know that affects a lot of the pool, which I am fully aware of. It's all out of my control, unfortunately. But, you know, I'm one of the few women left at Baseball Prospectus, and I would love some diversity in my staff, and I can only do so much. And unfortunately, it's just not coming together yet. And I thought that I was in a position to maybe, as a woman, be able to say, look, like, I did it, you know, I'd love to help other women or non-men, you know, get started, even if it's just for fun. And we're not quite there yet, unfortunately.
Yeah, this seems like it's a recurring problem with this sort of thing. At the blog I contribute to, Dodgers Digest, we recently had an opening and we, you know, put out a call for applications. We got about 50 or so, and literally one of them was from a woman. The rest were all from men. And we, you know, were obviously pretty disappointed with that turnout, but this just seems to be a recurring problem. So what do you think are the biggest reasons why more women and NBs don't apply or don't enter this field, either professionally or as a hobby?
Because we've been told most of our, or at least I'll speak for myself, I was told most of my life that I couldn't do this because I wasn't a man, so I never bothered until I was like 20 years old. And at that point, it was honestly too late because this field is so incredibly difficult to break into professionally. And if you look at, I mean, since I tweeted that I would like to diversify the applicant pool, I've had people in my mentions for 4 days, I think, at this point. You know, women shouldn't be doing this. This is a man's world. Like, and so you're faced with so many obstacles going into it. I personally know that a lot of days I just want to give up because it seems too difficult. And I think a lot of other people think that too.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that, you know, especially being someone who's dealt with so many trolls in their mentions going, you shouldn't be writing about X, Y, and Z. So what do you think are some possible solutions to the problem? Do you find that non-men have to be specifically reached out in order to apply for positions?
I wish it weren't so. I think that hiring or employers or editors and blogs, unpaid, whatever you want to call them, I think there could be more effort into it, but it also, I really don't know how to fix it, which is a problem because it's so ingrained in this community and writing communities and honestly the world that men have their roles and everyone else has their own roles. And I don't really know how to fix that. You know, newspapers should be hiring more women and non-men and blogs and TV shows and everyone. And you just kind of have to keep doing it until hopefully it becomes the norm as opposed to I have to make a point of saying it every time. But I really don't know how to do it, which is part of the reason why I'm here.
Yeah, I think it's such a difficult thing to find solutions to, especially for people like us who don't have that much influence, you know, in relation to the overall structure of baseball writing and of society as a whole. I think that it's kind of easy to say what should happen. So, you know, places, you know, should put, you know, women as NBs, especially people of color into management positions, which might make people more likely to apply when they see that they're not going to be responsible to, you know, five white men. So I think that's something that should happen. But like, how do we make it happen is a much more complicated sort of thing to get into.
Right. And even, I mean, when you're young, I would have loved to see, if I had seen female sports writers maybe I would have realized earlier on that I could do this, and I would have started earlier and actually made it work. So it's, there are a lot of steps. It's just, there's not one like, oh, the Washington Post has like a bunch of female sports reporters, which is phenomenal, but that doesn't fix the problem. And it does, it helps a little bit, but it's just, is one thing.
Yeah. There's things that are start, then there's things that are actual signs that, you know, very real progress has been made. And I think that's a start. Like, obviously it means that we've come a long way, because that wouldn't have been the case, you know, 50, even 25 years ago. But right. Nonetheless, it's, you know, it's, it enough, it is not enough on its own.
Right. And yeah. The fact that they had to put out a press release to say, look, we have all these female sports reporters. You shouldn't have, and it was great. It was a great article. These women are phenomenal. But it shouldn't be a big deal that you have women and non-men on your staff.
Right.
Yeah. I have to say, I do think there's definitely something to the whole specifically recruiting women and non-men and just generally more quote-unquote diverse candidates. Because I know for me personally, I never would have thought this was something I could do if people hadn't reached out to me. Like, you know, the first person who reached out to me with an offer to write for money was Paul Sladen at the Hardball Times. And he, you know, just found me from my own little dinky blog I was running for fun. And he was the one who was like, yeah, want to like write stuff for us from time to time and we can pay you. And I was like, what? That's nuts. I didn't know that was a thing I could do. And with the Dodger blog I contribute to, they specifically went out and reached out to me and another woman, who we both came on at the same time. And again, like I would have, if I just seen like this job opening at this blog, I know I never would have gone for it. I would have thought I had no chance. So again, like the fact that people specifically reached out to me, that made a huge difference. And I know that's not always an easy thing to do, because you might not always be aware of women out there who are, you know, available and qualified, and they, and even if you do make the offer, they might not accept it. But I do think that it's an approach that can be effective, because, you know, it's like that whole thing where like, I think it's if men will apply for jobs if they meet like 60% of the qualifications, whereas with women, it's, they have to meet like close to all of them in order to be willing to apply. And obviously that's a big generalization, and I'm sure it, you know, varies depending on the person, but I do think that the general principle is definitely in play here.
Yeah, I mean, I started writing at Amazon Avenue, which is the Mets SB Nation blog, and I just respond. I was sitting at a city council meeting, and I responded to a call for reporters or for writers, and that was how I got started. And I still spent like 3 days freaking out about the fact that I had done it. When I moved to BP, I think I spent a week saying, "Should I apply for this? Should I do this? Oh my God, are they gonna hate me?" Until my friends finally said, like, we already talked to them. They want you. You just have to send them your resume. And I don't know a lot of men who do that before they apply for things. So that generalization works for me.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, just kind of going through my own experiences, you know, just seeing a lot of men have these this confidence, like, I've been to a lot of baseball conferences, and I have seen so many young college-age men just walk up to general managers and, you know, chat them up and give them the resume, whereas, you know, women and non-men who are also at that conference are a little bit more timid and not sure if they should be going up there and talking to a general manager and giving their resume and talking about, you know, their qualifications and stuff. And it is very, very, it's very frustrating and also very anxiety inducing, because you don't know where your place is. And if someone had told me beforehand, like before watching everyone else, like saying, no, yeah, it's okay, you could do the same thing as these, you know, very confident men, you know, I think I would have approached everything in life just so differently.
Yeah, I think, and I want to make it very clear, I think everyone should have that confidence. I don't blame the men for having perhaps too much ego.
Yeah,
I think they're doing it the right way.
Yeah, I just want that confidence instilled on, like, everyone, because...
Exactly.
You know, everyone deserves the same opportunities, and if they have a chance to, you know, walk up to someone and say, hey, here's my resume, this is stuff that I've been working on, keep me in mind for a job, it shouldn't just apply to men.
And I think another issue that non-men run into is the fact that we often are boxed into writing specifically about issues that pertain to our gender, as opposed to, you know, more broader things in baseball, particularly more like statistics-based pieces. So I think that it's kind of difficult because a lot of pieces that pertain to women's issues should be written by women, but that also makes it seem like that's the only place that women can fit into writing about baseball, which is not the case at all.
Right. I mean, I can do marginal, saber, math, you know, analytical. I never really liked that, so that's not as much as what I write. But I would be glad to hire women and not men who write that as well, you know, especially with that stuff. There, you know, you're looking at numbers. Literally anyone can do that if you have the training for it. I mean, there should be no gender issues there whatsoever. But it is, because that's what we've all been raised on.
Exactly. It's just, essentially, it's a frustrating example of how society is so entrenched in gender roles that it extends to our little baseball writing community, and it's just, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, and I sit here and I try to think, you know, I don't think I've made it, but I have a lot more opportunities than a lot of people, and I would like to help, but I don't know how to get out there and say, you know, I can't say I only want to hire women, obviously, can't do that. But it's so hard to change what you've been told your entire life and what you've been convinced that you can't do this or you can only do parts of this. And I really don't know how to get through to a large group of people who have been told that they're just not welcome here.
Yeah, it definitely takes a lot of time and effort to be able to change people's fundamental understandings of, you know, what baseball writing is and what it could be as a more inclusive community. So, It's definitely difficult for, like, one individual person like you to kind of see this problem and not really be able to fix it on your own.
The rise of like blog culture and like blogs actually being taken somewhat seriously when it comes to this stuff, I think has helped somewhat, because in general, it's opened up access a lot more to who gets opportunities to write. You know, obviously the fact that most don't pay, or, you know, you get like ad revenue at best, that is a barrier still, but, you know, for a lot of people, they can be encouraged to do it as a hobby and it can end up leading to something more. I think that there's something to be said for that as an avenue, but again, it's a matter of, you know, getting people who wouldn't traditionally apply in, yeah, the mindset where they would, and that, yeah, we're still kind of searching for that.
And like, so, you know, you're reaching out to specific people, and this is a personal thing, but I don't like doing that because I know I can't pay them. Like, I don't want to DM someone, say, hey, come write for me, I can't give you anything in return other than exposure. Like, I just, like, if they want to come to me, great, but I just personally feel so squeamish doing that. And I know that's, you know, that also doesn't help. But
yeah, no, totally. That makes a lot of sense, especially since, you know, women and non-men are more in a position to not be able to afford to take on unpaid positions, considering so many factors in life that just don't let them have the opportunities for unpaid things unless they are willing to take that on. So, yeah, I can definitely understand, you know, your point of view on all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think in terms of, you know, people, specifically men in management type positions, and then, like, obviously it's a little different for, you know, people who, you know, don't have the time to do this because, they also write about baseball as a hobby, but I think it's important for men in these positions to, you know, afford protection for their, non-male writers on staff, who might receive a lot of backlash online. I think that's, you know, something that, definitely needs to kind of be more the norm, because it is, you know, so much a part of, non-men writing about baseball and, you know, I think fearing the sort of comments that they know that they'll get.
Yeah, I actually had like 3 or 4 times this week, I've had friends who are not part of like this community text me. They go like, "What in the world is going on in your Twitter?" And I said, like, "Just don't go into my mentions. Like, it's just don't do it. It's not worth your time." But that is a huge reason, I think, of why people are scared to do it, because you see this application and you scroll down and you have death threats 3 tweets later. I don't know that I would want to put myself in that situation either if I wasn't already here. So it's a vicious cycle, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's so many things about writing and sports writing as a whole that are just incredibly frustrating, and I wish I knew how to change it, but it also seems as though every time that there's a little bit of progress, people try to push back on it so much to the point where it just gets unbearable sometimes, and sometimes I don't know how I've managed to stay a baseball writer for as long as I have. So it's just a very, very frustrating thing to see.
It is. And there are some people in power who do want to see this change, and that's great. But there's a lot of people who have an opportunity to help change it that either don't see it as a problem or don't care enough to do so. And again, that's all cyclical, because if we were given the opportunity to get to those positions, we could help put more people in those positions, but not quite there yet.
Yeah, I don't know if it would have to be like kind of a ground up situation where, you know, readers of these places start to really kind of make a fuss about lack of representation on the writing staffs. And then that would force management into doing something about it, if it started to threaten readership. But I don't know if that's feasible.
Yeah, I don't know that. I think, like, baseball, Twitter, like, our very tight-knit group, it's disproportionate, incredibly so, to the overall readership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all care about these things, but I think most baseball readers and fans and readers in general don't actually care. So it's a nice idea. I just don't know that I believe that that is possible.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just, yeah. I mean, from everything that I've seen, you know, it would be great, but also just kind of looking at, you know, recent articles online about diversity and, you know, specifically in the baseball community, you know, writing about these issues. And I just look at it and making the mistake of reading the comments, and I'm just like,
oof.
Why did I do this?
Yeah,
why is
no,
the world like this?
Don't read the comments.
Rule number one, that literally everyone never breaks and then hates themselves afterwards.
Yeah,
never, ever read the comments.
So that was just a very, very frustrating thing to see, especially, you know, most of the readers of these, you know, publications are like, no, I don't want diversity in my sport.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or they'll say it is like, sorry, no, they'll say it is like, oh, why are you making it about, you know, blah, 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 why are you making that diversity, race, whatever their particular bugaboo happens to be. You know, it's like, why don't you just hire the most qualified people? And it's like, that's just such a narrow-minded view of things.
Right. And, like, I am trying to hire the most, you know, the best qualified people. But I also want to know that they're there, which is a lot of the problem. Eric Simon, when he was running Amazing Avenue, used to turn the comments off when I wrote about anything that was more than just, like, injury reports, because they would get so ugly. And he texted me or emailed whatever one day, and he was like, are you okay with this? Like, do you want to see the comments? Like, do you want to know that they're out there so we can do something? I was like, no, I'm not going to read them anyway. But if there's a woman out there who is reading the comments, it's going to scare her more than it scares me. So do someone else the favor. Not that I want to pretend that this isn't happening, but we don't have to make it as obvious that it's honestly a miserable place to be sometimes.
Yeah, and I think, you know, every non-man is fully aware that this exists, whether they see those comments or not.
Right.
And so it's just, you know, getting ignorant men to understand that this is a problem, which I don't know if they would be swayed by those comments anyway.
I think essentially, you know, women and non-men just need to be aware that there is, you know, a small circle of women and non-men baseball writers who will have their back. And I think just knowing that the support is out there would also help a ton. It's just very hard to, it's very hard to make that circle aware to people immediately. And it's one of those things where it just seems like, okay, you're in the club when you start writing, but I think it's just needs to be a little more open. But at the same time, it's like, how in this industry where there's so many people and factors working against someone, how are they able to see that there is some kind of, like, beacon of safety?
Right. So. And then if you put yourself out there, are you inviting more problems as well?
Yeah.
It's, I mean, we keep coming back to it. It's a whole lot of questions, and I just don't know how to fix any of it.
Yeah. It is just one of the most frustrating things to try and figure out how to fix and how to make everything just a tiny bit better.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it really must just have to start from, you know, non-men encouraging other non-men to apply for these positions and you know, just letting them know that, you know, we're out there and we're supporting them. And, you know, while that may not be fully enough, it's definitely something that can get the ball rolling.
Yeah, I think just having awareness of the fact that it's an issue is helpful in and of itself, because a lot of people just don't think about it. And if you're not thinking about it, you're not going to be able to ever do anything about it. So that alone is an essential part of it, though obviously the steps after there get a good deal more hazy.
Well, thank you, Kate, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You can follow Kate on Twitter at Kate Feldman. That's Kate with two E's. Thank you so much again for joining us. And if anyone out there is listening who is, you know, woman, not a man, please do send your applications Kate's way.
Thank you, guys.
This is a special week here at THT Audio because we have two guests, and our second one is joining us now. She's an organic chemist turned patent examiner and a Hardball Times contributor. In fact, one of her Hardball Times contributions was just voted winner of the Contemporary Baseball Analysis Award from the Society for American Baseball Research. She's Stephanie Springer. Stephanie, how are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. First of all, Stephanie, congratulations on the award.
Thank you.
So for those who don't know, your winning piece was called Get a Grip, which is a very well-researched look into the science behind baseball grip-enhancing substances. For those who have yet to read it, would you mind briefly summarizing your findings for us?
Sure. So I think, just as a little bit of background, I think everyone is familiar with this baseball rubbing mud that is currently being applied to baseballs prior to games to help give baseballs a little more of a tacky feel. And I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago that Rob Manfred and the commissioner's office had made some comments about working on a baseball that already had this grip-enhancing substance already kind of built into the baseball, kind of like what they use in Japan. So what I did was I took a look at the chemistry behind the rubbing mud and perhaps some other alternatives that could be used, such as what pitchers use currently is a mixture of sunscreen and rosin. I tried to look at what maybe they're doing in Japan and some other spray-ons and, like I said, a built-in product where you could just take a baseball out of a package and use it right away.
As someone with a scientific background and a focus in chemistry, you've got a very unique perspective when it comes to your baseball analysis. How did you start writing about baseball, and how does your scientific training inform the way you see the game?
Well, I think, taken very broadly, I think all sabermetricians are scientists, right? We all like to look at the evidence. We often postulate ideas. We come up with theories and hypotheses, and then we look at the data. We look at the game. We actually try to test our hypotheses. Now, it's a little tricky because we're not actually playing the game, but we can still collect data and analyze that. And so I think just naturally that draws me to baseball. I guess I've always been a casual fan of baseball, but it wasn't until someone told me, you know, you should read Moneyball. You would actually really like baseball a lot more if you thought about it a little more. It's not just something where I'll go to a game and watch, but I think finding the sabermetric community really enhanced my appreciation of the game. And I think that's just, it's in my nature to appreciate the science behind things. So I think I kind of saw that there's not a lot of people in that are looking at it from a scientific perspective. And I've been extremely fortunate that first Dan and Chuck at Saber Seminar and then Paul and now Meg at Hardball Times have really given me a platform to kind of share how I look at baseball through a scientific lens, whether that's just looking at steroids or and now these chemically enhanced baseballs and say dietary supplements, which is actually something I've been working on with Meg. So it's been really nice to be able to kind of share my perspective with other people, and I hope everyone has been enjoying it.
Yeah, we definitely have been.
And I think that's what's so great about baseball is that there are just becoming more and more avenues for people to look at it in various ways and to start to examine things that have been, thus far neglected or not looked into widely enough. So I think it's great that people like you are coming up and finding these sorts of opportunities.
Yeah, it's been really, really, really nice. There's no wrong way to enjoy the game. So, it's been great that I've been able to kind of apply my chemistry background to baseball. And I hope I can continue to do so. Hopefully that'll bring other people to the game too.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, they don't kind of like your experience. They don't necessarily realize that there's all these other dimensions to the game that kind of go beyond just what you see happening on the field. And, you know, there are definitely ways to kind of tie it into your interest. Like I know for like us on the show, we're all really into history and, you know, it's a game that's so rich with history. And, you know, you might not, if you're just following the contemporary game, you might not necessarily think, oh yeah, there's like so much that you can learn about, you know, not just the game itself, but about, you know, the history of America just by, you know, following the history of the game. That sort of adds this dimension that makes it even more appealing. So yeah, it's definitely cool that baseball is something that allows you to kind of bring in other interests and use other areas of expertise and training and help in turn enhance the understanding of the game.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk some about the recognition that you got for your article. How did you find out that first you were nominated and then won the Saber Award? And what was it like to receive it?
So the whole thing has been really amazing. I got a late night email letting me know that I had been nominated and that the announcement for the nomination would be made the next morning. And then voting went up the following week. And I told everybody I've ever met, I asked them to vote for me. Like even my best friend from daycare 35 plus years ago voted for me. So it was really nice. I mean, it was just nice to share with everyone that I've been kind of like doing this stuff on the side. And I mean, just finding out that I won was just unbelievable because I wasn't expecting it. The competition this year was really stiff. I thought for sure Ben Lundberg's story was going to win, since I know he's done so much work looking at the juice ball. And so it was such an honor just to be nominated, let alone win. And so it worked out really well. I had wanted to go to the conference anyway, and so I had already, fortunately, I'd already made plans to be in Phoenix, to do a little spring training, during Saber Analytics. And so when, Jacob kind of said, oh, are you gonna actually be at the conference? Could you try to be there on Sunday? it was just really, really exciting. So, hopefully I was standing in the back of the room, for most of the conference with the stroller with my toddler. So hopefully it didn't interfere with anybody, but, it was just a great experience all around. And I mean, obviously it was receiving the award was great, but just being at Saber Analytics and, seeing all the great research that everyone's been doing, it was a really great experience all around.
Yeah, that's really, must be such a fantastic experience. And I think it's something that is very richly deserved. And it's good that, you know, baseball is starting to diversify and starting to recognize, some of these people that like you who certainly deserve it, and who can help bring other people to the game and help people find their own voices.
Yeah, it was nice. And like I said, really, it's when I submitted an abstract to Saber Seminar, I was not expecting Dan and Chuck to accept it because, you know, it was a little different and everything I do is a little different. And so I think it just goes to show that you never know who else is going to be interested in hearing your own unique perspective on the game. So, speaking of which, Saber Seminar is looking for abstract submissions now, so why not apply? You never know what's going to happen. So,
right. Speaking of your unique perspective on the game, let's return a little bit to your article. So do you predict that we will actually see a change in baseball leather production to have improved tackiness built in anytime soon in Major League Baseball, or is it something that might be a little more far off?
So I think that there's actually everything that they need is there. So I think at this point, for all we know, actually, they might have already started using this. From what we know of how MLB works with Rawlings, it kind of seems like the specifications are pretty loose in a way. MLB tells Rawlings, this is what we want the final product to be, and it has to have particular center and it has to have leather on the outside, but they don't really have a lot of specifications as far as like what type of leather do they need. The way that they end up describing the baseball that they want is kind of a final product. And so, what I found was Rawlings actually already, has a an agreement in place with a company called Horween Leather. And so Horween Leather makes leather for footballs for the NFL. And so obviously there's other considerations when you're dealing with a football. I mean, obviously there's a pebbled texture, but there's precedent to, there's a reason to think that, you know, it wouldn't be that far-fetched for Rawlings to just already talk to their current leather maker and say, you know, we would like to have a leather that already has something extra of grippy, kind of impregnated into the leather. So I think that there's definitely, all of the pieces are there. And it just also knowing that, you know, in NPB, they already have these grip-enhanced baseballs. I think it's going to happen pretty soon, if it hasn't happened already, that they've already started kind of going down this path.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I think it's something that's going to be interesting to see, you know, unfold, you know, whether it be the sometime this year or within the next few seasons. So something to keep an eye on for everyone who's interested. We will link to Stephanie's Sabre award-winning article in the podcast post on the Hardball Times site, because it's definitely worth your time if you missed it when it originally ran. And you can follow Stephanie on Twitter at Stephanie Kays. Stephanie, thank you again so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And now for this week's Twitter questions. This one is from at Sully Baseball. Shouldn't the season start in March and end on Labor Day, making August the time for pennant races?
I say no for two reasons. The first of which is that it's just far too snowy and cold for all of the northern teams that do not have domed stadiums to start play in March. We already kind of run into issues with games being canceled due to snow, you know, for the first couple of weeks of April. So that would just lead to a lot more doubleheaders and a lot more scheduling conflicts and loss of probably most off days for a lot of teams. And secondly, October is just the most perfect month of the year. And part of that is because of baseball playoffs going on at that time. So I don't want to lose out on that.
100%.
I'd have to agree. Like, the first thing I thought of was, but the snow and the weather, and like in California, you know, at least the northern part of California, you know, there's so much rain that goes on in March, and there's just going to be so much rain delays, and you know, it's just not worth it to have so many games rescheduled. And you know, like Mary said, that's just going to cut into so many off days. And then by the time, you know, the pennant race would come about, it's just going to be a frustrating race, because you don't know if any of these players are going to be extremely tired by that point. So I would have to say, you know, if there were a lot more domed stadiums, you know, then maybe it would make sense having the season end on Labor Day. But the way that it currently is set up just makes more sense due to Mother Nature and really everything else.
My reaction to this when I first saw it was sort of more of the gut response of, no, it's so, there's something so like poetic about, you know, the opening in the spring and everything is new and beautiful, and then it ends in the fall, and, you know, the whole green fields of the mind thing, basically. And, you know, that definitely is a part of it, and I think a part of what makes, you know, the whole baseball experience as romantic as it is. But yeah, there really is something perfect about October being the time when, you know, you have this, like, basically the most exciting thing going on, which is the baseball playoffs. And yeah, I think that the logical reasons are also very good. I think that, you know, that is a, it's good to back up the sort of emotional reaction with facts. But for me, so much of what kind of appeals to me about baseball is the way it kind of follows the seasons. And I just, it would hurt to lose that.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think that, you know, not only that, I think it would also kind of mess up the cohesion between Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball, because Minor League Baseball, as it is right now, starts in the second week of April, usually about a week and a half after Major League Opening Day, and ends on Labor Day, leading the playoffs to the first 2 weeks of September. And the reason they do that is, you know, in case anyone needs to be called up, or, you know, making sure that players in the organization who need extra playing time have ample travel time from whatever affiliate that they're currently at to the one that's still playing. And, you know, there's always that last 2 weeks of the season between the last of the minor league playoffs where a player can still get called up to the major leagues. And it's just a lot of logistical things with organizational affiliations as well. So I think the consensus is no, the season should not start in May, in March, and end in Labor Day. I think if baseball started in May, we would all die. Our next question is from Jack at J Ford Bear. What do you think is the bar for a successful season for Ohtani?
I think in my mind, it's a sub 4 ERA and a 700 plus OPS. I think those are real enough numbers for people to believe in his abilities. And, you know, I think he'll probably just get better from whatever he does this year, provided he can stay healthy. And yeah, I think that if you have a guy who is an above league average pitcher who hits regularly and can hit over 700 OPS, then it's, I would like to see anyone seriously try to argue that that's not impressive and that doesn't provide some serious value to his team.
Mm-hmm. I agree with those numbers, but I think I'm just going to go a little broader and say that for me, it would just be him improving throughout the season, because it's his first season in the major leagues, and that would demonstrate that he will likely improve throughout the seasons. So I think that as a first season, that's just kind of a basic bar for success.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, as long as he proves that, you know, he's making adjustments and consistently getting better at both the plate and on the mound, I think that would show a lot of success for him. And I think that's where the bar should be. From a statistical standpoint, I think that if he puts up at least a WAR of 3 or 4, you know, that would be a successful season for Ohtani that I don't think is too out of the question, considering that he is both a hitter and a pitcher. So I think the bar has been somewhat reasonable for Ohtani so far, but who knows when opening day comes around.
How do you calculate his WAR for that? Would you just, like, add them up separately?
I'm wondering. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, now when you have pitchers who actually make positive offensive contribution to their team, that gets added to. Well, it depends on what leaderboard you're looking at. But I think, like, overall, when you look at most leaderboards, it incorporates both offensive and pitching WAR in there.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, that if, you know, depending on the leaderboard, it's either going to be separate, but a lot of formulas now factor that in, especially for pitchers, because, you know, DH doesn't exist in the National League. I know, much to your dismay, Mary.
It's gonna happen. Just you wait.
Can we banish her from the podcast?
I am a firm proponent of National League stays DH free, American League stays with a DH, and that's why there's two leagues.
Yeah, I'm with you, Jen.
Anyway, this week's article summaries. Mary?
All right, so it's a fantasy baseball week at the Hardball Times. If you're interested in getting some tips from experts on how to make your team better, which I should probably do as well, head over to fangraphs.com/THT to see what the Rotograph staff has to say about everything from avoiding the post-breakout year trap to the impact of the 10-day DL on fantasy.
And next week, we have John Paschal delivering his guide to watching the 2018 season. Eli Ben-Porat looks at Mike Trout, StatCast darling. Annie Maroon makes her Hardball Times debut with a story on her path back to baseball fandom. Ryan Pollock looks at the most underrated base stealer of the 80s and 90s. And Frank Jackson looks at who has the potential to be the new king of career strikeouts. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at fangraphs.com/THT, and you can find the site on Twitter @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter @JenMacRamos. You can find Sarah @SarahWexler32, and you can find Mary @MiriamCraig, and you can find the site on I can find the podcast on Twitter @THTAudio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.